So I'm curious, by a show of hands, did anyone make the effort to see the eclipse on Monday? Okay, now, did anyone actually travel away from the state to go to like Nebraska or one of these other places to see the totality of the eclipse? Did anyone? No. Yeah, did you? Are you being serious?
Everyone and I were in Sedona.
Oh.
We went hiking in the morning.
Uh-huh. You didn't sleep through it. Are you serious? Well, good news for you, Lynn, good news. I did some checking, and this is no joke. There's going to be an eclipse in Little Falls. I'm not kidding. In Little Falls. You guys think I'm making this up? I can already tell. Okay, this is not a joke. There's going to be, Little Falls will be the center of a totality eclipse moment. And all we have to do is hang in there until 2099. That's right. I'll be 123 years old. So I've decided to start eating healthy, you know, so that maybe I can make it that long. You know, it's a little bit humbling because then our daughter, who's 7, will be 89, you know, if she makes it that long, you know. So if anyone is here that's like less than 7, you have a chance. You know, Rory, you got a chance. The average lifespan for men is like, what, somewhere between 76 or so. So not looking good for you. If you're a gal here and you're like 0 years old, you're close, because I think the average lifespan for women is around 81, 83 or something like that. I don't know why that is. Women are healthier than men. Maybe it's our stress levels or something like that. Either way, so be encouraged. All of you can be encouraged that someday you have the opportunity to see this totality in 2099. September 14th, mark your calendars, 2099. Little Falls will be, it would be pretty cool, wouldn't it? You just step out on your deck and then you don't even have to travel, and then maybe you'd sleep through it still. You know, at that age, if I live to be 123, I'm probably sleeping through it. Just throwing that out. But it's interesting, okay, so With this eclipse, and I read some articles on it, and this is fascinating. I did not know some of this, but did you realize that Earth is the only planet in our solar system that has this opportunity, that has an eclipse like what we have? You know, that's remarkable, and they say it is so rare, so odd that such an event would even happen. So here's the idea of it. This is not to scale, just so you know, but what we have is you got the sun, you got the moon, you got the earth. So this is a little science lesson for those who don't know what the eclipse is. But when they all line up like this, you get the shadow projected on the earth. That's the eclipse, where the moon blocks out the sun. But what's fascinating with our eclipse that we experience is because of the fact that this distance here, which is labeled as X between the moon and the earth, is 400 times less than the distance between the sun and the moon. And then the size of the moon is 400 times less than the size of the sun. Because of those distances and sizes, they're so specific, we experience an eclipse. And I can't imagine that when we look at our solar system, which has 8 planets, 9, 10, I mean, they kind of fluctuate back and forth. They can't decide how many planets our solar system has. But either way, whatever number our solar system has, with all the moons that exist around these other planets, it's fascinating how all of those other ones don't have an eclipse like what we have, and yet we do. And do you think that there was a hand that had a role in that? You know, that God designed it in such a way that we have this experience and the other planets don't. You know, there's even, and this is what I was struck by as I was reading some of these articles that I came across, and obviously, you know, we didn't experience totality, but we had some sunglasses. We just used dark sunglasses. It's fine. My eyes hardly feel the effects. But with the idea of the eclipse, you know, we got to experience it. We didn't experience totality here. But even with that, and then you experience God has created with that, and how he put the planets in place. Even his creation will cry out as to who he is. You know, and then we even see in the scriptures about that. We even see in the scriptures, and one of the songs we sang about it this morning, the heavens will declare his glory. You know, they will declare his majesty, and that's exactly what we experienced on Monday. Whether you saw its totality or not, I mean, it's God's creation coming together and to create this. You know, some people, they got a little bit over the top. I'll give you that, okay? Some people were driving, trying to follow it, trying to find sunshine. Oh, that's just over the top. But there's a reality to the fact that what God has created points back to him. So I couldn't help but emphasize that this morning. And then likewise, I couldn't help but think, you see what he has created and how it points back to him. But then you look at what we looked at last week, and you see this picture of his kindness. Not only his creation that points back to him, but then you see it pull back and you see his kindness, how kind he is to us, draws us into repentance. You saw it with the woman last week when Jesus was interacting with this woman. You see all these other people are ready to condemn her, and yet it's Jesus' kindness that draws her to repentance. And that is just as amazing as his creation of the astronomy and the stars and the galaxies and everything else that we get to see. And so last week, we came to this point. We were confronted with grace and what we're going to do with this grace. We were confronted with looking at this woman who was caught in adultery, caught in sin, and she desperately needed grace. There's no question about it. She's in a position. She's guilty. And everyone else is ready to not offer her grace. They're ready to condemn her. And yet here's Jesus Christ, the one who could condemn, and he offers her grace. And likewise, then, in a sense, he's challenging us to also do the same, because everyone around this woman who's ready to cast stones at her, Jesus calls out to them and says, if you are without sin, then by all means, go ahead and throw the first stone. And they're convicted of this reality that I am not sinless. I have sin. And so I also then need grace, because anyone who has sin needs grace. We talked about that last week. And so where are you at with grace this morning? I've looked at this past week for myself, and I think I could identify every day this past week, either or both, myself needing grace, or in many cases needing to offer grace. And grace is just, it's a constant. You know, it comes through our lives, and we see its need all over the place. I mean, you look at our culture, you look at our world right now, and the news. I know there's some heavy things in the news. You know, the hate that we experience and that we see. We see the attack in Barcelona. We see the attack in Charlottesville. We see violent protests. And where will we find grace? And grace, you can see it's desperately needed in our world. And there have been more and more stones thrown each and every day and each and every year. And what you see is more and more hate building. People picking up stones, proverbial stones, and casting them. We see it in our culture, in our politics. It's just a series of casting stones, and where's the grace? Our president of the Alliance, the Christian Missionary Alliance, released a statement this last week. I'd like to read it for you. It's dealing with the events that kind of spurred it on in Charlottesville, and I think it emphasizes our role in this idea of grace, and this is what he says. He says, it is the church that must continue to lead our world with Christ's message of hope and reconciliation. The events in Charlottesville were yet another grim reminder of the racial hatred that plagues our world. Our spiritual adversary continues to seize every opportunity to pervert the rich, harmonious diversity our Father designed. You see that? He designed it. That he designed for his pleasure and our delight. Anyone who elevates or isolates one race reveals that they have no comprehension of the New Testament, nor the Messiah who came to redeem and reconcile all people. It is the church that must continue to lead our world with Christ's message of hope and reconciliation. At this moment in American church history, I stand with my sisters and brothers whose heritage as earth's citizens differ from mine, but whose heritage as heaven's citizens is the same. I stand with them in grief, I stand with them in hope, I stand with them in prayer, and I call our entire Alliance family to do the same. We as the church have an opportunity to show grace. And oftentimes I think we default, and we talked about it last week, with this idea, I have this stone in my hand, what am I going to do with this stone? And by putting the stone down is a moment by which we choose to show grace instead of revenge and bitterness. And it's a hard place to do that in our world right now, because we have so much violence, so much animosity. But it is our role as the church to show grace. So this week we're going to find, and it's really good, and between this week and then next week, we have this John chapter 9 chapter. And in this chapter, what we're going to see is today we're going to see Jesus is going to heal this man who's born blind. It's a great story because we're going to see some historical pieces there that was oftentimes believed, and the ignorance that oftentimes comes with some things that we think we know and we have no idea. And then next week, we're going to see how he flips the table a little bit. We're going to talk about physical blindness today, and then next week, Jesus flips it and goes into this idea of spiritual blindness, and it's really wonderful. And what we're going to see today is we're going to deal with some questions. We're going to deal with one question in particular that was common in the day, in this New Testament time, very common, and people would kind of argue about it. It's like this proverbial question of, what is this? Is this right or is this right? How does this happen? And we'll talk about that in here a little bit. But here's how this starts. So as Jesus went along, remember, we just finished up John chapter 8. And in John chapter 8, Jesus and his disciples had been at the Feast of Tabernacles, very full place, all right? This temple was just packed with people. And in this midst of this packing of people, Jesus makes some huge proclamations. He says, I am the light of the world, all right? All that light that led the people in Israel back out of Egypt, that was me. I am the light, claiming to be God. And then we also saw how he confronted these Jewish leaders, and they're saying, wait a minute, are you saying you're greater than our father Abraham? And Jesus says, guess what? Not only am I greater, I'm way before him. I am the creator. And he says, before Abraham was even born, I am. And it's interesting in that statement. What Jesus is really saying is, before Abraham was even born, I am. Jesus is saying, I am eternal. And there's only one that can be eternal, and that is God himself. And that's a powerful statement. And I just don't want you to miss that statement. With Jesus Christ in John chapter 8 is literally claiming to be God. And what we're faced with then is, if Jesus Christ is claiming to be God, will I believe what he says? Will I believe that Jesus is who he says he is? We keep saying that phrase week after week. Will I believe that Jesus is who he says he is? Because if Jesus is who he says he is, then that my life has to respond to that. If Jesus Christ is God, like he says he is, then my life has to respond to that reality. And so what we have here then is, after they've left this temple, now they believe that there's this time between the end of John chapter 8 and the beginning of John chapter 9. Some time has gone by. So this isn't Jesus just exiting the temple and heading on down. They believe time has passed, because if time hadn't passed, there would be great animosity yet, because the way Jesus left it with those Jewish leaders and those teachers of the law, I mean, things were hot. Remember, right when we concluded John chapter 8, people had picked up stones and they were ready to throw them at Jesus, and Jesus somehow slipped away. Somewhat miraculously, we don't give details on that, we don't receive it. But there's huge animosity when we finish John chapter 8, we start John chapter 9. It seems like things have at least settled somewhat. But it doesn't take long before they build up again. And so what we have here, so as Jesus is going along, it does appear that he is leaving the temple grounds, temple area in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, the temple would have been up on a hill, and so you're actually heading down. It was very common in this day that people who didn't have a means by which to earn their own income would beg. They were beggars. And there's a lot of reasons why that would happen. We'll cover that in a little bit. And so what it says is, as he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. This is common. Look at it, Mark chapter 10, verse 46. So this is Jesus and his disciples again, they came to Jericho, and as Jesus and his disciples together with a large crowd were leaving the city, a blind man, this time named Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. So this was common. These people who couldn't earn a living by working would sit there and beg, and they would pick these prominent places to do so. There's more evidence here in Acts chapter 3. This is in the New Testament church time, still New Testament though. So not very many years passed after Christ had been crucified, buried, and risen, and then ascended. Now it says in Acts chapter 3, verse 2, a man who was lame from birth was being carried to the temple gate called Beautiful. There's one of the temple gates that was called the Beautiful Gate, right? That's what it's referring to, where he was put every day to beg from those going into the temple courts. This is common, all right? This guy's lame. He can see, but he can't work. And so what would happen is he couldn't even get there himself. So he'd actually have people carry him, set him at the temple gate on their way to the temple. They would leave him there, and he would sit there all day at the gate, because that's where people are going in and out. That's his best chance to receive the money that he would get. And people would walk by. Some people would throw some money in. Many people would just walk by, because he's there every day, not even notice, maybe choose to kind of direct their attention away. But he's likely not the only one there either. there would be reasonable to suspect there would be a number of beggars at each different place. It's kind of like they have their spot, if you will. This is my street. This is where I work. This is my gate. This is where I work. And they have a number of them at each of those places. We see more evidence in Acts 14. In Lystra, there sat a man who was lame. He had been that way from birth and had never walked. And so there's more examples that we could look at as well. But this reality of it is, these people who couldn't work, this is what they would do. And in fact, the one that we were talking about here today, the one when they were born that way, it was likely what would actually happen is they're being raised or being cared for by their parents, but then they would hit an age by which they had to start, you know, earning to help support the family, to learn to help support themselves. Well, most children, like boys, when they get up to that age, their fathers would come beside them. They would teach them the trade. They would teach them if they were fishermen, they'd teach them how to fish. If they were a carpenter, they'd teach them how to build. And they would do that. Well, in this case, if you can't see, if you can't work, they were actually taken out and they were placed alongside the street, alongside the gate, and they were taught to beg. How humbling. I mean, and some, it had to be, I don't know if we want to go that far, but say humiliating. But yet, what could they do? In that culture, that was what they had to do to be able to survive. You know, so a mother, you can imagine a mother and or a father taking their child out there maybe for that first time, setting them by the gate and saying, all right, this is what you do. This is where you're going to be. This is your job. You're going to beg. You know, because those children had to start earning income to help support their family. That was very common. You look at Jesus, for example, when we don't know when it happened, but it appears that Joseph, his father, died. Jesus was a carpenter. Jesus was working as a carpenter to help support himself, to help support Mary in this time. This is before he started his public ministry. That's what was done. And so here we have this man who's born blind, and at some point he's got to be put there for that first time, and he's learning to beg. And then as they were there, they're coming out, they see this man, it says Jesus saw this man who was born blind. And the disciples ask him this question, and looking at the question, where in the world does this come from? And we'll talk about that. But so his disciples said, Rabbi, which means teacher. All right, this is kind of a reversion, the right word, but it's a pullback into looking at Jesus as your teacher. Jesus, you are the rabbi, you are the teacher, you're the one that's teaching us all this stuff, and we have this question. And this question kind of comes from this idea that this was that unanswerable question that people had, that these Jewish leaders had. We'll talk about that in a moment. So he said, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents? It's not a question of did or did not this man sin. The question is, who sinned, this man or his parents, that made him so he was born blind? People knew that this man was born blind. All right, they knew, we don't necessarily know how they knew, it's possible that he literally had no eyeballs. And so they could tell from birth that nothing had developed there. That's possible. It's also possible that people were blinded from injury. You know, and these people that would be taught to beg, it's possible. Some of them maybe were working as a farmhand. Maybe they got kicked in the head by an animal. Maybe they got stepped on, their leg was crushed by an animal. And that eliminates them from being able to work, so they have nothing else to do but to start begging. And this is what they were learning to do. But here the disciples see this. What happened to this guy? I mean, this poor, suffering man. Was it his sin or his parents' sin that caused him to be blind from birth? This question comes from some, I would say, even somewhat misunderstood passages in the scripture. You know, we do see evidence in the Old Testament, evidence even in the New Testament, that sometimes God causes and allows disease, sickness, I suppose you can even say injuries in some capacity, as a cause or a punishment, if you would, from sin. That happens. You know, we see evidence in the scripture that way. But what was end up happening here, and so with all these people there, these lame people, these blind people, these Jewish leaders in particular, these teachers, these other rabbis, like the disciple just called Jesus, these other rabbis would see them, and they would have these philosophical discussions. Well, whose sin do you think caused this man to be this way? What, do you think it was his sin? Do you think it was his parents' sin? And they would have these philosophical discussions, likely even in front of the person, almost like they're an object, because they didn't see this person as a human. They didn't see this person as a soul. All they saw was what they believed was this man's sin. They disdained the people. They saw no value in these people because all they could see was, oh, your sin has made you this way. It kind of serves you right. And this was common for these Jewish leaders to just kind of, I'm sorry, we're so self-righteous, we're so pious. I'm sorry your sin has caused this, but you really deserve it. And Jesus is going to flip that in a little bit. But they came to this idea because there's certain passages in the scripture that leads them to believe that all iniquities were caused by sin. All death was caused by sin. There's some examples. Miriam, if you remember the story of Miriam in Numbers, I want to say 11 or 12. Miriam was the sister of Moses. Well, Miriam at one point said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right. Why is Moses getting all the attention? And kind of confronts Moses on it. And God gets upset with Miriam and says, don't you dare question the person that I have put in charge here. And gives Miriam leprosy. So you see that sickness being caused directly from sin. You know, and then God obviously does restore her then thereafter. But a lot of it ends up coming, we see it in Exodus chapter 20. Verses 4 through 6. And this is a passage that perhaps we have heard, perhaps we've understood, but it's coming from the Ten Commandments. And there's a section here where it refers to how from generation to generation we will suffer the consequences of the sin of our forefathers. Well, there's an interesting point here. So this is what it says. It says, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing. This is where they get it. And so they assume that sin is coming from all over. The disease is coming all from the sin. Punishing the children for the sin of their fathers to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. But showing love to a thousand of generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. I'm not discrediting what that's saying and even some of that understanding. However, there's something that's very important to note there. The pronouns that are being used in that passage, the you, they have in the Hebrew what is known as the plural ending. And so really what that passage is saying is, it's you as a nation. You know, this is, we've pulled it, these Jewish leaders pull it down to the individualistic, but it's really intended to be you as a nation. So in other words, you leaders, as you lead your nation, and you continue to turn your backs on me, guess what you're going to see? You're going to see that nation struggle. You know, and yet when that nation continues to follow me, you're going to see that nation blessed. And I can't help but wonder if we're starting to see that a little bit with America. You know what I mean? And there's some, when we look at that, it's like, that makes some sense. So in other words, you know, and that doesn't eliminate me as a parent and as a father of having some responsibility. What I choose to do is going to affect my children. However, what we end up seeing in some other passages like Ezekiel 18, and this is what it says, the one who sins is the one who will die. The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child. The righteousness of the righteous will be credited to them, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against them. And so this is what Ezekiel is saying. We see also in Jeremiah. Jeremiah, in those days, people will no longer say the parents have eaten sour grapes. Here's the idea. I had a sour grape yesterday. I'm not kidding. It was nasty. I tasted the sour grape. My children did not. I just want, you know, so my teeth, in a sense, were set on edge when I ate the sour grape. My children's were not, and that's what Jeremiah is getting at here. So in those days, people will no longer say the parents have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Instead, everyone will die for their own sin. Whoever eats sour grapes, their own teeth will be set on edge. You know, and don't get me wrong, there is examples in the scripture. You think of when Israel went in to conquer the land of Canaan. They come to Jericho, they conquer Jericho. And they were supposed to burn everything. Well, Achan had different things in mind. He saw this robe that he really liked, and he decided to keep it and some other treasures. And they go into the next town to conquer that, and God said, uh-uh, you guys didn't obey me. And we see in that situation that Achan and his entire family were put to death. I don't know all the answers, but what I do know from my studying is we look at this section with this man. When Jesus comes along, he sees this man that it is not his sin that has caused his blindness. It is not his parents' sin that has caused his blindness. And yet what you have is you have these Jewish leaders that are convinced it had to be his sin. It had to be his parents' sin. And Jesus is going to show us something totally different. As we get on, I wanted you to notice here. When, as he, which is Jesus, went along, he, Jesus, saw a man blind from birth. I don't want us to miss the fact that Jesus, as he's walking, notices this man. Because really, reality, hundreds of thousands of people have probably walked by this man and never taken the time to notice him. Our president, John Stumble, also, he wrote an article probably about a year ago about laying out his vision for the Alliance, and he wants us to see, he wants us to notice those who are invisible. You know, those kind of people that we choose not to look at sometimes, because we know that if we look at them, it's going to cause, you know, some challenges. It's going to cause us to have to react. You know, those who maybe have physical ailments. You know how it is. Sometimes we go to a place with our children, especially when they're really young. They see someone, whether they have a malformation, whether they're in a wheelchair, and your children stare at the person. And we tell, what do I tell our children? Stop staring at them, you know? Because we would rather, let's be honest, we would rather not notice, because that's more comfortable than taking the time to notice. And Jesus, I think, is going to challenge us on that a little bit this morning. So as he went along, Jesus sees this man, he notices this man, he's going to respond to this man. In verse 3, Jesus answers his disciples and he says, guys, neither this man's sin nor the sin of his parents, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. For years, this man has heard words of disdain as people have said, oh, you're this way because of your sin. You're this way because of your parents' sin. Years and years. No pity from the Jewish leaders. Basically sending this message that you got nothing. You're worthless. Sorry. This is all you can do is sit here and beg. And Jesus says something totally different. What Jesus is saying in this passage, catch this. Jesus is saying, you've been created this way on purpose. We don't like to think that, do we? In other words, Jesus is saying, you were made blind, and it wasn't an accident. It was on purpose. And my reaction would be a little bit, it's like, well, what'd you do that for? You know, that's no fun. Why would you do that? That just seems mean. That just seems nasty. Why would you do that on purpose? You know, the reality of it is sometimes there's aspects of our lives that we don't like who we are. We don't like parts of us. We don't like the way that we are sometimes. I mean, let's be honest. We've all had moments where we've kind of wrestled with that. Is there anything you don't like about yourself? You know, sometimes maybe you don't like the way that you look. You know, maybe you struggle with math or you struggle with reading and you can't stand it and wish you were different. Maybe you don't have the athletic prowess that you wish you had. Maybe you wish you had the athletic prowess that you had when you were younger. You know, would it make a difference if Jesus were to come to you and tell you to your face, I did it on purpose? That's the way I wanted you to be, because I have a purpose for you, something that I have created you to do, and this is how I need you to be able to do it. And so Jesus is basically telling this guy, you're blind, and I did it on purpose. How do you feel about that? I mean, does it bother you? Because there's an aspect of it that kind of just bothers me a little bit. But I read this in the InterVarsity Press commentary on this passage, and this is what it said. God does not allow anything to enter our lives that is not able to glorify him by drawing us into deeper intimacy with him and revealing his glory. Johnny Erickson Tada, maybe you've heard the name. Fascinating story. She's a painter, and she is a quadriplegic. She was in a car accident. I want to say it was in roughly 1982. It left her paralyzed. No use of her arms, no use of her legs. She's in a wheelchair. She's been in a wheelchair for 30 plus years. And yet, she continues to paint, and she uses her mouth, and she does amazing work. But this is what she says. She says, my weakness, that is my quadriplegia, is my greatest asset, because it forces me into the arms of Christ every single morning when I get up. Perspective is a powerful thing. You know, she wasn't created that way, but God certainly allowed that to happen. And she recognizes her catastrophe. She recognizes her tragedy as something that has caused her to be who God wants her to be, who God has, in a sense, created her to be. And she's had a great platform by which to share the love and the gospel of Jesus Christ. And she, I think she recognizes, would not have that platform had that not happened to her. And yet, I gotta be honest, I don't want to suffer. I don't want to be paralyzed. She also says, this is in regards to Alzheimer's disease. She says, Alzheimer's disease is never an accident in a marriage. It falls under the purview of God's sovereignty. In the case of someone with Alzheimer's, this means God's unconditional and sacrificial love has an opportunity to be even more graciously displayed in a life together. You see that? Sometimes our suffering isn't necessarily so much about, you know, us as it is about others coming closer to Christ. You know, for someone that has Alzheimer's, their mind is such a, it's a decay, if you will, you know, where it's decreasing, and it goes so fast sometimes, and it's a loss, and it hurts, and it's like, ah, how can we deal with that? And yet what it does is it displays to the world how a spouse can come alongside the one and demonstrate that unconditional love, and it points back to Christ. That's a powerful picture. And I'll tell you this right now, and I know some of you remember the LeClaires, but you see it right now. Andrew, if you remember Andrew, his dad has Alzheimer's. You see it right now with Jim. That's his name. Jim's wife, Betty. That's a beautiful picture. That's got to be extremely hard, but it's a beautiful picture. Watching Betty love Jim unconditionally. So anyone who looks at what's going on in that marriage has to wonder, where does that come from? That is amazing. So as we move on. So neither this man, Jesus says, nor his parents sinned. But this happened on purpose. I made you this way on purpose so that the works of God, remember what the works of God are? We saw it back in chapter 6. The works of God is this, to believe in the one who he has sent. Well, so there's this idea, I made you this way on purpose, and I did this on purpose so that, guess what? People are going to come to believe that I am who I say I am. Because of your blindness, people are going to come to believe that I am who I say I am, and that is Jesus Christ. Isn't that something? So verse 4, and what we have here in verse 4 and 5, he gives us this little bit of a picture how temporary, there's going to be something happening here. I'll tell you what it is. So as long as it is day, we must do the works. This is to help people to believe that Jesus is who he says he is, to believe in God. That's what the work aspect is. So we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming. And when no one can work, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. This seems to be kind of just shoved in there. And it's like, what are you getting at here? And I think what Jesus is really getting at is there's going to be this moment. You know, you heard me say it before, I'm the light of the world. Well, there's going to be this moment where suddenly there's not going to be anything that's going to lead people to believe in me. For 3 days, you're going to have this moment where it's like, I don't know what to believe anymore. So that night is coming. But while I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. So as I'm the light of the world right now, you have something to believe in. There's going to be a death. And guess what? And this is what I think he's getting at here too. This man, this blind man, has been suffering since he was born. I'm going to understand suffering because night is coming. And when that night comes, Jesus is going to suffer beyond anything we can imagine. Blindness is nothing compared to what Jesus suffered on the cross. And it wasn't the pain, all the pain and the agony, but the carrying the weight of the sin, the real sin of the world. And so that's going to be for 3 days, and then that light will come back. Verse 6, it says, after saying this, and I love this. So after saying these things, or he says, this man was not born blind because of sin. I made him this way on purpose. He's got a work to do. He has a job to do. He doesn't even know what that job is going to be. And so then Jesus, what he does is he takes and he spits on the ground. He starts stirring up the spit on the ground, and he makes some mud out of it. And he takes the mud and he puts it on the guy's eyes. This is gross, isn't it? You know, if I was the blind man, I wouldn't want to see that coming. That's a bad joke. Should not have said that. That was totally distasteful. Anyway, after saying this, he spit on the ground and he made some mud with the saliva and he put it on the man's eyes. Kind of thankful he was blind, probably. Look at this in Genesis 2. I think there's a connection here. says, "Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being." In Genesis, we get this picture how God takes and forms from the dirt, basically in clay, and you can envision him molding this. And I see this idea of Jesus spitting on the ground. He healed people in different ways. All right, sometimes there's one episode where Jesus actually spits right into the man's eyes, like no mud. He just spits into the man's eyes. Sometimes he speaks the word and these people are healed. And I'm convinced that Jesus does it in a variety of ways because he wants people to understand there's not, there's nothing magic going on here. My word has power. Whatever I choose to heal is going to be healed. Okay, I can spit on you. I can make mud. I can throw it in your face. I can speak the word and you will be healed because I'm the one with the power. It's, you guys can make all your magic and whatever else you think is going to work. Make all your salves. That's not going to fix it. I want you to grasp there's a variety here. The power comes in me, not just these little trinkets. So I think that's why Jesus is doing that. But look at this. You see how God took and he formed Adam, literally touched and formed this clay into the shape of a man, and then he breathed life into it. I can't help but wonder, maybe this guy didn't have, literally, his eyes hadn't formed from birth. I can just envision God or Jesus taking and making the mud, putting it in his eyes, almost as if he's taking this mud and he's creating something brand new, just as God created Adam from the dirt. There, I'm making you some eyeballs. Now go wash off the mud, and when you come back up out of the water, you're going to be able to see. The same fingers that we saw last week drawing in the dust created this man some eyes. This also points to the fact that Jesus is doing this healing of blind men. This is pointing back again to Jesus is who he says he is. This is pointing back to Jesus is the Messiah. And this is what it says in Isaiah 35, verse 5. It says, "Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped." And what this is a prophetic passage from Isaiah talking about who this Christ will be and what this Christ will do. And this is the example right here where it says, "The eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped." In other words, this Messiah, when he comes, he's going to help the blind to see. And Jesus does exactly what Isaiah 35 does. John chapter 9, verse 7. So he says then, after he has put mud in this guy's face, give me a moment. So Jesus puts mud in this guy's face and he says, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam." This word means sent. So the man went and washed and then he came home seeing. Can you imagine? For the first time ever, this guy was born blind. He has not seen anything. He has no idea what Jesus looks like at this time. Just want to be clear. Okay, he has no idea. He hasn't seen anything. He goes and he washes his mud off in the pool and he comes out and now he can see everything. What a life change. You're going to see some things next week with the same guy. It's wonderful. And what you see is you see Jesus or this guy coming back after Jesus has healed him and you're going to see how he's a follower of this Jesus. You're going to see automatically how he's testifying to what this guy does. He's talking to these Jewish leaders. He doesn't care what they think and he just kind of lays it out there. Say what you want. But I know one thing. Before I couldn't see and now all of a sudden I see you. I see everything about you. The passage wraps up, verses 8 through 12. And so after this had happened, it says, his neighbors, those people who knew this guy, his neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging, so they had seen him at that temple gate. He was there every day. They asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and to beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he just looks like him." Okay, he's just kind of a look. Yeah, it can't be. It can't be the same guy. He just looks like him. But he himself insisted, "I am the one that couldn't see. I am the one that was blind, and now that I can see." In verse 10, he says, "How then were your eyes opened?" they demanded. He replied, "The man they called Jesus." I have no idea what he looks like. But the man they called Jesus, I've heard them. He's the one. He puts the mud in my eyes. And he told me to go wash in Siloam. And so I went and I washed, and then I could see. And they said, "Where is this man?" I have no idea. I don't know where this man is. I want us to grasp a few things this morning as we look at this. And I believe that I got four application points, and I want you to listen, because I think that we can aspire to one or more of these and be able to grab hold of them. And the first one we talked about was in verse 1, where Jesus comes down and he notices that which had previously been unnoticed by so many. The only thing that people were noticing about this blind man was his sin, enough to be able to talk about, oh, whose sin was it? And Jesus doesn't see that. Jesus doesn't see disdain in this man. Jesus looks at this man that he had created, that he had made this way on purpose, and he sees him as a human being. He sees him as a soul. How often do we walk around and not see people as a soul? You know, I can't help but think back to our experience in the Dominican Republic when we went to the Casa de Luz, the House of Light. There's an orphanage, and this isn't the average orphanage. This is the orphanage where anyone who's there, staying as an orphan, they've been given up because they were born with a defect. And most of them, or many of them, were cast out. I mean, literally left on the curbside for someone to come across and find. And we don't want to notice things like that, because that forces us to have to respond, I don't want to notice things like that. And yet when we come face to face, it's like, wow, what Jesus, God, what do you do with this? This passage helps me a little bit, because I'll tell you this, from our experience in the orphanage, I believe that I'm not the only one who remembers what we encountered that day and is continuing to find themselves affected by what they encountered that day. You know, sometimes we have placed so much onto that life that we claim is invisible, we'd rather not see. We look at that life as being like, oh, how could God do that? Well, maybe God did that because he wants to change you after you've encountered that. You know, you follow what I'm saying? So I think we're being called to notice more than we choose to notice sometimes. I remember as a child, there was a man in my hometown. I grew up in Wadena, about an hour or so north. His name was Gordon Olson, no relation. But he was born with a birthmark. He had half of his face and half of his neck was a big purple birthmark. I mean, just huge. You know, and I remember looking at him, I was like, whoa, what happened to you? You know? And when we'd go, we wouldn't necessarily go to visit, but there's a couple times where we knew him, we knew of his family, and so we were there for various reasons. And I remember looking at him and thinking just what I said, like, what happened to you? And he was keenly aware of when people, especially kids, I think, kind of were aware of him and his face. And so he would even call us on, oh, you know, he wouldn't hide behind it. What do you think? You know, I don't know, it's very, very weird. But he told us this story one time. And he tells us this story that he was at a restaurant, and he's sitting there with his wife. He was married. And in this restaurant, there was another family, and there was this girl who was staring at him. You know how it is, parents stop staring, okay? But this girl wouldn't stop staring at him. And she's staring at his face, and all she can see is that bright, bright, I mean, it was noticeable, bright purple birthmark. And she ends up, finally, she says, what happened to your face? And this guy kind of chuckles, and he laughs, and he says, well, I've always had it. I was born this way. And she continues to look at him, and she contemplates, and finally she says, you know, purple's my favorite color. You know, here's a girl that noticed him as a person, you know, and I know that's just a birthmark, you know, but we see things like that all the time. We choose just to kind of look away, choose not to look. But what a sweet picture of how I think even Jesus looked at this blind man and saw not just the fact that he's blind and not accusing him of his sin or his parents' sin, but it's like, oh, you're a soul. You're somebody. In fact, you're somebody I created you that way for a purpose. I have no idea, you know, Gordon, with his face like that, I think it was on purpose. The effects of it, I don't know. But it certainly seemed to have an effect on that girl, which had an effect on him. I don't know where it all leads. I just shared the story with you. You see what I mean? What God does sometimes, I'm getting ahead of myself, not only do you notice, but it's on purpose. I want you to understand that Jesus knows you in your suffering. This man, this blind man, he suffered for many years. We don't know how many, but he suffered for many years blind, sitting there, humiliated, ashamed of the fact that he had to beg for a living because he couldn't see, he couldn't go out, he couldn't work. But Jesus understands his suffering, and a few months, years after this fact, he's going to suffer beyond anything that this blind man has ever suffered, anything we have ever suffered. He's going to suffer. He's going to suffer severely. He knows you in your suffering. So if you're wrestling and you're suffering right now, I know, I'm sorry, I can't make it better. And Jesus can, to an extent, he can heal you from your suffering, okay? But in many cases, he won't. He'll let you continue in that suffering to, as Johnny Erickson talked about, to be intimate with him. You know, and so I don't get why he chooses some, why he chooses others. However, both will point back to him and draw into that intimate relationship. But he knows you in your suffering. Corrie Ten Boom shares a story in her book, The Hiding Place. Her and, oh, what was her sister's name? Betty? Not right. Betsy. I was close. Thank you. So she shares a story with her and her sister, Betsy. They were imprisoned at a concentration camp during World War II. Horrible conditions. And there was this moment that Corrie just ends up saying to Betsy, they found out they had that fleas. You know, it's like, what could be worse now? We all got fleas, all right? And she lays out to Betsy, Betsy, why would God do this? And Betsy just says, you know, let's just ask God to show us. And then she begins to list these different things, and she lists, I'm not going to remember them all. One of them, she lists, you know, our crowded. We need to be thankful for God that our space is so crowded. And Corey's like, what? We're so packed in here. Why would we be thankful for that? And Betsy says, because more people will be able to hear these scriptures that we're sharing. You know? And then she gets on and she shares some other things. She comes to the fleas. And we need to thank God for the fleas. And Corrie says, what? Are you crazy? And she says, I don't know, but we're going to thank God for the fleas. Well, sometime after the fact, I think it was Corrie that overhears one of the guards, because they would basically from barracks to barracks, they would go in and they'd search them. They wouldn't allow scriptures. They wouldn't allow these things. They would oftentimes take these, you know, certain barracks all out at the same time to have them executed. Well, this barrack, they hadn't been coming. And Corrie overhears the fact that they haven't been coming, and they've been sharing reading the scriptures every night inside the barracks to all these other women. Every night. You know, they're here, they have the scriptures. They're not supposed to have them. Corrie overhears the guards saying why that was happening is because none of the officers, none of the Germans wanted to go anywhere near the fleas. So they were thanking God then for the fleas. They kind of hit. God gave the fleas, and as suffering and as miserable as that was, it enabled the scriptures to be read and enabled them to be protected, that they weren't hauled off into the gas chambers. I don't know. But God knows us in our sufferings. And third is, I want you to understand that your life has a purpose beyond yourself. In Ephesians, this is a passage that's very interesting. Not even in times when I was studying, I go through and kind of study throughout the week. But this verse just kept coming up to me this week on several different occasions. Someone, you know, would email it to me. I had one, I was searching for something else, and for whatever reason, this verse popped up, and it's fitting, and I want to share it. But Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, it says, "For we are God's handiwork." Okay, created, it's not just by accident work. This is handiwork. This was crafted, expert craftsmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, to help people believe that God is who he says he is, which God prepared in advance for us to do. Psalm 139. This, if you're struggling and you're trying to find what is my purpose, read Psalm 139. This is just a snippet of it, but that is so rich with who God has created you to be. Psalm 139, 13 and 14 says this, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together piece by piece. You made me the way that I am. Whether I have a birthmark on the half of my face or whether I've been born blind, you did it on purpose. I don't know why you did it on purpose, and maybe sometimes I feel like I'm frustrated that you did this on purpose, but you knit me together in my mother's wombs, but I will praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well." That's hard to read sometimes when I think I look at myself, why in the world did you make this mistake? And he says, I didn't. You might be really bad at this, but there's a reason that you're really bad at that. Jeremiah 29:11 says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. These are the plans I've laid out for you. I've made you this way. I've laid out these plans for you, not to harm you, but plans to give you a hope and a future." And finally, we see it just briefly there when God puts, Jesus puts mud in this man's eyes, it's this, our faith is called into action. You know, we've been called to believe, we've been called to understand that we've been created for a purpose, but then our purpose isn't just idle. You know, he calls us, you believe in me, and I'm going to give you works to do. And those works aren't like do this, do this, do this. They're really the idea of these works are the fact that you're going to lead other people to believe in God, lead other people to believe that Jesus is who he says he is. I'm going to invite Kevin and the worship team to come up. And we're going to sing. I'll come up and give a benediction and pray for us afterwards, but reflect on this reality of how you have been created and that you have been created on purpose for a purpose.